The Chinese New Year, we've already had our New Year, the Chinese New Year will begin on what we call January 31st on our Gregorian or Western calendar. And when I was considering a good date to focus on and explore both the history and potential contemporary meaning of the I Ching, one of China's contributions to the classics of world religious literature, a time close to the Chinese New Year seemed auspicious. And when considering criteria such as longevity, domestic significance, and global spread, scholars rank the I Ching in the same league as the Jewish Talmud, the Christian Bible, the Muslim's Quran, the Hindu tradition's Bhagavad Gita, and Buddhism's Lotus Sutra. But before proceeding much further, I should probably clarify a few issues of nomenclature, spelling, and pronunciation related to the I Ching. If you understand Chinese, and did anybody raise their hand earlier when Laura asked if any Chinese speakers? That's unfortunate. I really think that's the coming age, right? We should all be having our children learn both Spanish and Chinese, probably, to be on the safe side. But if you did understand Chinese, the simplest approach would be to render the word I Ching, of course, in Chinese characters. But in the English-speaking world, that leaves us with a dilemma of choosing the best transliteration among the current options, none of which, of course, are fully adequate. You never really have an adequate case when you're transliterating. For instance, long before I took my first religious studies class, when I first saw the title of this Chinese religious classic written out, uppercase I, then a space, and then that separate word, C-H-I-N-G, I assumed it was pronounced I Ching. And this was years before Apple started, putting an ironically lowercase I in front of all of our personal technology products. But that phenomenon has only made the traditional English rendering even more confusing, making it more likely that the uninitiated will pronounce it I Ching instead of I Ching. And that more familiar I space C-H-I-N-G comes from the transliteration process known as the Wade-Giles system, which started in the 19th century and was popular in rendering Chinese into English throughout most of the 20th century. And as you can perhaps guess, Wade and Giles were not Chinese. They were British sinologists. And in recent decades, however, the pinyin system has replaced, that literally means spelled out sounds, pinyin, and which was developed by the Chinese people themselves, has replaced this former Wade-Giles system. And in pinyin, the title of this world religious classic, you'll see it in the sermon title in your order of service, is spelled Yijing, Y-I-J-I-N-G, which avoids the confusion of spelling the English word with that first letter I and then space and then C-H-I-N-G. But it has the problem, at least for now, is that many English speakers recognize that spelling, I-C-H-I-N-G, and don't recognize Yijing. Like, how many of you have seen the spelling I Ching, the I... I-C-H, right, and how many of you have seen Yijing? Okay, nope. There you go. So there's a similar issue with the more confusing but also more familiar issue with the Tao Te Ching, which C. Raven is rightly using for the chalice lighting and the chalice extinguishing words. So we're familiar with this romanization Tao Te Ching, T-A-O space D-T-E space C-H-I-N-G. But the problem with that is it's spelled, of course, with T, right? So many people pronounce it Tao Te Ching, but it's supposed to be Tao Te Ching. So this whole Wade-Giles system is very confusing, and you can see why it got replaced. But in contrast, the pinyin version that's becoming much more popular, especially in scholarly circles, is Tao Te Ching, spelled D-A-O-D-E-J-I-N-G, all one word, very similar to the I Ching. So you're going to see that more and more. And for what it's worth, I think that this minor learning curve of familiarizing English speakers with the more accurate and more authentic transliteration of the I Ching and for other related things is worth it, because it's important whenever possible to call things as similar as possible to what the original culture chooses to call it. And if you'll allow me a very brief rant, I have long thought that it is a spectacularly bad idea for every language in the world to have a different name for every geographic geographically and culturally specific term. The most prominent example I can think of is the confusing and unnecessary practice of every country in the world having a different name for every other country. Why do we go to the trouble of inventing the word Germany when we can just call the country what the German calls themselves, which is Deutschland, exactly, or for Japan, Nippon, right? Or for Spain, España, or for Greece, Hellas. And that last one, Hellas, of course, makes so much more sense. We don't call it when Alexander the Great conquered the world in 333, and that's why, the Bible was written in Koine Greek, the New Testament. We don't call it Greekification, right? We call it Hellenization, because, of course, the Greeks call themselves Hellas, not Greece. So it just makes sense on so many levels. But anyway, I don't want to get too off track, but suffice it to say that learning to recognize the title Yijing is similar to learning to recognize that more common, increasingly common transliteration for the Quran, Q-U-R-A-N, as opposed to the one that you used to see, which was K-O-R-A-N. The Quran with a Q invites you to pronounce it in a way that's much more similar to the Arabic. Here endeth the rant. So, returning our focus to the Yijing, I think that the first reference I ever saw to this Chinese religious classic was in, of all places, a G.I. Joe comic book. And not to get too unduly nerdy for those who aren't children of the 80s or who didn't have children who grew up in the 80s, the gist is that the two ninjas in the G.I. Joe comic book world had the same symbol tattooed on their forearm. Anybody with me on this? Anybody? All right, a few. All right, okay. It turns out that tattoo that these G.I. Joe ninjas had on their forearm is the 63rd hexagram in the I Ching. And that hexagram was water over fire and was perhaps chosen to symbolize the opposing tensions that those two characters represented in the G.I. Joe mythos, if you will. But more importantly than unpacking what those 1980s comic book writers had in mind by choosing that particular tattoo, what I remember most is finding those tattoos so arresting. The design was so simple of that 63rd hexagram, but I remember finding it transfixing. And as you may know, the Yijing is based on a series of 64 six-line symbols known, as I said, as hexagrams. And you'll see an illustration of the first 16 of those 64 hexagrams in your order of service. I would have put them all, but that would have taken up too much room. Under the sermon title is where you'll find that illustration. The first hexagram is a solid six lines stacked on top of each other. They're built from bottom to top. And the second hexagram is six broken lines. So it's constructed from the bottom to the top. It's six parts. So there's each of those dashes are connected in each line. The other 62 hexagrams you'll start to see from even those first 16 are permutations of those first two paradigmatic symbols. And another name for the Yijing is the, quote, classic of changes or book of changes. And those names likely refer literally to the Yijing being this iteration of changes of these two basic symbols, as well as the Yijing being a divination manual intended to discern how one should proceed given the flow of the ever-changing universe of which we are a part. And scholars date the origin of the Yijing 64 hexagrams to approximately 3,000 years ago. You'll see some earlier claims, but scholars would say the best guess right now is around, like I said, about 1,000 BCE. And as one scholar has joked, you don't have to be a Freudian to surmise that those first two symbols are derived from the male parts and female parts, respectively. If you take a look at those first two hexagrams in your order of service, I feel that you are all smart enough to infer which sex corresponds to the tower created by the solid column of six lines, and which sex corresponds to the tunnel, if you will, created by the stack of six broken lines. And after the initial 64 hexagrams were created, within a century or so, each hexagram acquired a name, a brief description known as a judgment, and a short explanatory text of each of its six lines called a line statement. And this highly compact document, less than 4,200 characters in length and probably first inscribed on strips of bamboo, became known as the basic text of the Yijing. And the Yijing became increasingly popular and respected, including by the Chinese emperor as early as 136 BCE, after a set of commentaries known as the Ten Wings became attached to the basic text in the 200s BCE. And although the historical Confucius, who actually lived a few centuries earlier than that, did not write these popular commentaries, they became attributed to him, likely in a very similar way to how early Jewish scriptures were falsely attributed to Moses, or that early Christian scriptures were falsely attributed to some of Jesus' earliest followers, in order to gain authority, in order to gain credibility. Nevertheless, because of that association with the historical Confucius, even if incorrect, for the next 2,000 years or so, the Yijing held pride of place in China as the first of the Confucian classics. And as a point of comparison, think of the just immense amount of close, extended scrutiny the Western world, for better or worse, has given to the Bible. And all the ways that the Bible's influenced Western culture, the Yijing has played a similar role in shaping Chinese culture for the past 3 millennia. And relatedly, one of the fascinating parts of studying the history of biblical interpretation, again to make an analogy, is that over time, the primary unit of interpretation has changed. In more recent times, we tend to look at a verse, we tend to look at a passage, or even the whole book of a focal text to get the surrounding context in order to discern meaning. But in the Middle Ages and before, there were large spans of time in which the common practice, especially in monastic circles, was to focus on just a single word as the unit of biblical interpretation, to riff on that word's etymology and potential hidden meaning. And likewise, in imperial China, it was not uncommon for a scholar to spend days or even weeks contemplating the meaning of a single hexagram. And for many decades, the most popular version of the Yijing in the Western world was Richard Wilhelm's translation. He was German. It was published in Germany in 1924. And then rendered in English in 1950 by Carey Baines, who is a student of Carl Jung. And that 1950 English version, you may well, if you've ever seen a copy of the Yijing, it easily could have been the Wilhelm version. That famously includes a foreword by Carl Jung himself. And I own both that version as well as a more recent version by a Chinese Taoist practitioner, which is called The Complete I Ching by Alfred Huang. So I'd recommend both of those to you if you're looking for a starting point of learning more about the Yijing. And if you know of a better, more authentic, authoritative version, I'd be interested to hear. For now, I'll share just a very brief method of using the Yijing. Minimally, you'll need 3 coins, or there is a way with bamboo sticks, but it's much more complicated. So if you have 3 coins and a copy of the Yijing, you're set. First, center yourself in silence. There's some more complicated things that if you really get into it, of the direction to face and lighting incense and all these things, but the 3 coins will start you. Center yourself in silence. Silently state your intention, which can be as simple as just seeking discernment. And when you feel centered, cast those 3 coins for the first time. Each heads that comes up is a 3, and each tails equals the number 2. And you add up the total represented by those 3 coins and those numbers, and if the total is an even number, you write down a broken line, and for an odd number, you write a solid line. And you need to make a note later if the total is a 6 or a 9, because those have a special role later in how the hexagram is constructed. You then throw the coins 5 more times, building your hexagram from the bottom to the top. So 6 times, 6 lines. And so, for example, the first hexagram that's in your order of service, that would be from throwing all odds, throwing 6 odds in a row. Or the second one would be from throwing 3 evens in a row, or you can kind of think through how the permutations would work. And once your hexagram is built, you find which of the 64 hexagrams it corresponds to, and that description is supposed to relate to the general situation in which you find yourself presently. And if you any of your throws were 6 or 9s, you then end by changing just those lines that were a 6 or 9 to the opposite line, and that creates a second hexagram, and that's supposed to show you where you're headed. So the first one, so that's the changes, that is sort of reading the changes. Remember, Book of Changes is another name for the Yijing. And there are more specific details I could add, but that's the basic idea, and any copy of the Yijing is going to give you much more instructions. But here's where it gets tricky. As one Western Yijing scholar notes, historically there has been, quote, no general agreement of how to interpret the results of a Yijing divination, and due diligence required, of course, a command of all major commentaries, which is no small feat. And that can really sound hard for an outsider in particular who didn't grow up in a culture saturated with Yijing interpretation. This really needing this deep familiarity with the text and the interpretive tradition. But that's really not that different than what you need, I would argue, to do a responsible interpretation of the Talmud or the Bible or of almost any sacred scripture. But although the Talmud or the Bible are sometimes used as divination manuals, perhaps unwisely, to be clear, the Yijing is precisely intended to be a divination manual. And these days, perhaps the most well-known reference to divination may be Professor Trelawney from Harry Potter, some of you may recall, who in that series often appears to be bumbling, but also has authentic flashes within the world of Harry Potter of insight. So, and that's often how some people find divination to work, that you do have occasional flashes of insight, though you also have sort of misleading fox trails. All that being said, what might a 21st century Unitarian Universalist make of the Yijing? Looking at the six sources of our living tradition, certainly as a classic of world literature, the Yijing is part of our third source, wisdom of the world's religions. And regarding this ancient divination manual, I think we're called to balance our first source, which calls us to trust our direct experience, with our fifth source, humanist teachings, which call us to heed the guidance of reason and the results of science and warn us against idolatries of the mind and spirit. Or as the fourth of our seven principles succinctly puts it, we are called to a free and responsible search for truth and meaning. So how might we freely and responsibly approach the Yijing today? To begin to answer this question, let me point to a few more instances in which the Yijing has infiltrated Western culture, not surprisingly starting in the 60s. In 1965, Bob Dylan told a Chicago reporter that the Yijing is the only thing that's amazingly true, period. He continued, besides being a great book to believe in, it's very fantastic poetry. Indeed, a year later, Allen Ginsberg wrote a poem called Consulting I Ching, Smoking Pot, Listening to the Fugues Sing Blake. Dylan also penned the following Yijing reference in the song Idiot Wind. Quote, I threw the Yijing yesterday. It said there might be some thunder at the well. Additionally, John Cage has used the Yijing in musical compositions as part of his composition process. But as interesting as these popular uses of the Yijing are in constructing a 21st century UU approach to the Yijing, I would look first to the groundbreaking Swiss psychotherapist Dr. Carl Jung, who again wrote that 1950s introduction to the first major English language version of the Yijing. And in 1949, Jung wrote, quote, For more than 30 years, I've interested myself in this oracle technique, or method of exploring the unconscious, for it has seemed to me of uncommon significance. Although Jung is a great proponent of the power of the scientific method and its pursuit of observable, replicable, falsifiable, things that can be proved false, axioms about the world, he was equally interested in subjective truth of what remained in the realm of one's direct, firsthand, interior experience. And part of Jung's interest in the Yijing was that the process of throwing coins and subjectively interpreting the results in light of one's perspective at that particular moment, for Jung, that really resonated with his theory about the importance of what he called synchronicity, or meaningful coincidence. And in 1949, near the beginning of the final decade of his life, well, he didn't know that at the time, but Jung additionally wrote to potential critics of his views of the Yijing that, quote, I know that previously I would not have dared to express myself so explicitly about so uncertain a matter. I can take this risk now because I am in my eighth decade. And the changing opinions of men scarcely impress me anymore. And the thoughts of the old masters are of greater importance to me than the philosophical prejudices of the Western mind. In other words, Jung is saying that in his mid-70s, he is finally feeling the freedom to speak freely about what he has found to be true in the crucible of his own firsthand direct experience, even if that truth can't necessarily be replicated in a scientific laboratory. Jung taught that two of the most powerful ways to become more aware of both your individual unconscious as well as what he called the collective unconscious, the source of these archetypes that appear in very similar forms across cultures, was to pay more attention to our dreams at night and to synchronicities during the day. To pay attention to your dreams at night and to your synchronicities during the day. And in addition to meaningful coincidences that we notice, he looked to the Yi Jing as a way to potentially cultivate synchronicities. And I've started dream groups in previous congregations that I've led that have explored synchronicities and things like the I Ching and dreams, and they've been well received. And if you're interested in something like that, I'd be glad to talk with you. I know that some members of this congregation have done that before and that there's even been dream groups here before. So I'm glad to talk with you more about that or working with dreams, synchronicities, Jungian psychology. And one scholar writing these days along these lines that I find particularly compelling and intriguing is Jeffrey Kripal. He did a PhD at the University of Chicago. He's chair of the religion department at Rice University. Kripal calls himself a mystical humanist. A mystical humanist. Chew on that for a little while. Is a term I find fascinating and filled with paradoxical potential. I'll be sharing more about Kripal in a future sermon, probably in March sometime, but for now, as we continue to reflect on what potential meaning the Yi Jing might hold, even in the 21st century, for Unitarian Universalists, meaning in the Yi Jing, meaning in Jungian philosophy, what that may have for us today, I invite you for now to rise in body or spirit as we sing together a hymn intentionally chosen from the Meditation and Mystical Songs section of our hymnal. Number 83, Winds Be Still.